I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us for another edition of The American Idea. Late in April 1945, bombers of the U.S. Army Air Force attacked the city of Linz in what had been until 1938, and which would be again from 1945 until the present time, in Austria. And we have a new book about this bombing raid. The title of it is Bombing Hitler's Hometown, The Untold Story of the Last Mass Bomber Raid of World War II in Europe. The author of that book is Mike Cresson. He is a retired CIA officer with graduate degrees from Indiana University and Missouri State University. I just learned that he did his undergraduate degree at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and was there as an undergraduate in history at the same time when I was there as a graduate student in history. But if we met, I don't think we really remember each other. But he is, Mr. Cresson is also author of The Armenia-Azerbaijan Conflict, Causes and Implications, which was published in 1998. He is co-editor of Oil and Geopolitics in the Caspian Sea Region. He is also author of several articles on security issues dealing with the former Soviet Union. Mr. Cresson, Mike, if I may, welcome.
Hi, John. Nice to see you.
Likewise. So tell me what inspired you to tell this story.
Sure. This began as a family mystery, actually. My uncle, Ellsworth Cresson, was a late addition to the war. He arrived in Europe in January 1945 as a bombardier in the 15th Air Force, which was the Air Force, the Strategic Air Force based in Italy. The other one, of course, famous for many reasons, including Masters of the Air, which is a new miniseries on Apple TV. They were based in England. He went over, like I said, in early 1945, flew 21 combat missions as a bombardier, not a scratch on him, returned to the U.S. after the war ended and was based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He was essentially running out the clock till his time in the service ended. Then he was going to return to Illinois, and eventually go to the University of Illinois to study agriculture. Unfortunately, one weekend, he was given a chance to hop on a plane on little or no notice and fly to Madison, Wisconsin, and then make his way south to Illinois. But the plane crashed and all aboard were killed. This was September of 1945. So I never met my uncle, but his death, he was one of eight children. His death really impacted the family. And they were never really told why and how he died. They were led to believe that the plane ran out of gas and that weather was a factor. So in the mid part of the first decade of the 2000s, I started to look into it in an effort to understand what happened to my uncle and perhaps give my family some peace and answers. My aunts learned of my interest in history, and through a fortunate series of events, I ended up with his letters that he had written home and some more documents. And I was able to piece together the bombing missions, most of them, that he participated in. Being a CIA analyst, I approached the subject analytically. I would look into each target that they bombed. Why did they go there on that particular day? Is there anything historically of note about that target? And what do you know? I came to Linz, Austria. That would be his last mission of the war, April 25th, 1945. And there I really became interested. I didn't know that that was the town that Adolf Hitler claimed as his home. I didn't know much about the city at all. And when I looked into it, primarily on the internet initially, I came across quite a few veterans' accounts of the mission, and they all described it as absolutely horrific. Hmm. The Germans threw up an enormous amount of anti-aircraft artillery fire, and the men were shot to pieces. So between that and the Hitler connection, I quickly, I'd say within less than a year, I was so interested, and I had enough material where I went from thinking I could write a book about this to I have to write a book about this. Huh. And I spent about the next 10 years or so interviewing veterans. I eventually talked to about 55 survivors of the mission and wrote a book. And I landed a book deal about a year and a half ago, and I'm happy to say that it's going to be coming out later this month, March 2024.
Fantastic. So tell me, let's step back a little bit. And why was Linz a target to begin with, especially this late in the war?
Sure. Linz was a target for several reasons, but the main reason was that Adolf Hitler wanted to rebuild Linz to be the cultural capital of Europe. He was very attached to this hometown of his. It wasn't his birth town. I want to be clear. It was the town where he sort of went through adolescence. Mm-hmm. He wanted to rebuild it. And as we all know, it's come to light that the Nazis were stealing artwork from all across Europe. They were going to put it in a museum that Hitler was going to build in Linz. He was going to retire there. He was going to be buried there. His parents were going to be reburied there. In order to pay for all that, Hitler industrialized Linz. The Hermann Goering works were built. This was a major industrial center where they fashioned steel, and later, as the war turned against the Germans, they started to build weapons of war there. In addition to the Hermann Goering works, there was a major rail center. Linz had always been sort of historically a center for transit because it was located on the Danube. But that was really reinforced with the construction of a major rail center. So between the weapons production and steel production and the transit aspect, Linz became a target. In July 1944, there would eventually be 22 raids launched against military targets in that city. And my book is about the final mission.
So this was only the last of 22. Well, tell me, if it was attacked repeatedly, was the German air defense on this last occasion greater than it had on previous times? And if so, why would that have been the case?
It was actually in April 1945, specifically April 12th, Vienna, the capital of Austria, fell to the Soviets. Unfortunately for our airmen, the Germans were able to pull many of their anti-aircraft batteries from Vienna, and they placed them in Linz. Vienna had long been known as one of the most heavily defended targets in Europe, and certainly in Austria. So the last time that the 15th Air Force went to Linz, they faced 110 anti-aircraft guns. Now on this mission, they would face 164.
Wow.
Linz had previously been known as a very tough target for the 15th. So the morning of the mission, when they're in their intelligence briefing and they're told there would now be roughly half again as many guns guarding the city, you know, many men told me that they were apoplectic. They just could not believe what lay in store for them. And unfortunately, those guns were brought into use, and the men had a very tough day.
When you say that Linz was already considered a tough target, was 108 guns considered a lot, or were there other factors that made Linz difficult?
I think Linz was always well defended because of the Hitler connection and because of its military importance. But by the time Vienna fell, again, 12 April 1945, I have an actual intelligence report from the morning of the mission that says that Linz has now become the hinge of German defenses in southeastern Europe. and that it's the last great communication, one of the last great communication center of the shrinking Third Reich. So
were there German fighters in addition to anti-aircraft?
Let me rephrase that. The intelligence pointed to a formidable German fighter threat that day, including the jet fighters. They were projected to be up to 60 of the new jet fighters. Fortunately, that didn't materialize on the day. There was a very small force of fighters sent after the bombers, but for the most part, fighters at this point in the war were not a major factor that the 15th Air Force faced.
Okay. So these 164 anti-aircraft guns unleashed murderous fire on these aircraft. Can you tell us a bit about the planes involved and how this raid went down?
Sure. The 15th Air Force was primarily B-24 Liberators, which is one of the two major heavy bombers used in the European theater. Roughly two-thirds of the 15th Air Force's bomb groups were outfitted with the B-24. The other third used the B-17 Flying Fortress. In the case of the 8th Air Force, that ratio was flipped. That was mostly a B-17 force. Linz, being located in north central Austria, it was a fairly long distance mission. It wasn't testing the limits of the bombers, but it wasn't just a short up and back kind of ordeal. And the aircraft carried 500-pound high explosive munitions to put the rail yards out of commission. The intelligence report that I found for that day noted photo reconnaissance results that showed up to 2,000 rail cars present in the extensive rail network in Linz. So this made it a target that had to be put out of commission. You know, at the time, there was this thought that the Germans would retreat to the Alps and launch a guerrilla war. That turned out not to materialize, but the thought at the time was, you know, these supplies need to be destroyed now or else they could be used later.
And that fear of an Alpine redoubt was why Eisenhower was not particularly interested in going to Berlin. Let the Soviets concentrate on that. We'll sweep down into Bavaria toward Austria. Okay.
And U.S. forces were approaching from the west. They were still several days out from Linz, but the Soviets were a little bit closer, coming from the east in Vienna.
So we mentioned the Alps. Were there special precautions that had to be made in flying over the Alps? I know this was the case in East Asia, flying over the Himalayas posed certain challenges. Were the Alps a special problem as well?
I don't know that they were a special problem. The men, of course, these bombers were unpressurized and largely unheated. So the men had to wear clothes to essentially keep them alive at high altitude. You know, above 10,000 feet, they had to be on oxygen. They had to have heated suits. They wore many layers of clothing, and one of the layers would plug into a socket at their position and provide heat throughout their body. This was an altitude at which a human being cannot survive for more than a couple of minutes. So just being at attack altitude, which for the B-24s today, on the day of the mission, was about 25,000 feet. For the B-17s, it was about 30,000 feet. So this was not an altitude at which a human can survive.
Right. Okay. So any particular mishaps on the way to the destination, or does the story really get going when they're over Linz?
Sure. 548 bombers take off, 32 return to base for various reasons, mostly mechanical failures. There are 200 fighter escorts. So we're talking about 700 aircraft in the sky, which is a pretty big raid. And I would like to address here the subtitle of my book, The Untold Story of the Last Mass Bomber Raid of World War II in Europe. What I mean by the last mass bomber raid is this is the last time in Europe an entire strategic air force was sent after one target. by this point in the war, both the 8th and the 15th Air Force were air forces were largely running out of targets. The 15th in particular had for a week or more prior to this mission been attacking individual targets in Italy. You know, at the time, the Germans were still retreating up the boot of Italy. So the men were going out after, in some cases, individual anti-aircraft guns, bridges. But this was the last time in Europe an American strategic air force went out against a single target. So they face immediate horrific gunfire, anti-aircraft artillery fire, rather, from the ground. Within the first 4 minutes, the first bomber is shot down. I have an extraordinary photograph of the bomber as it's going down over the target. We would eventually lose 15 bombers that day total, and 28 Americans would lose their lives. So the fire is extreme from the get-go, and many, many planes are damaged. And as I said, 15 are knocked out of the sky.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
If 15 are shot down and it's 28 Americans killed, does that mean some of them survived?
A great many did survive.
And taken prisoner, presumably.
Yeah, three B-17s and 12 Liberators were shot down. Mm. Nine of the crews ended up in German hands and six in Soviet hands. And that's a whole story of itself, what happened to the men. Roughly the first half of the book is the mission itself. And then the back half, I get into what happened to the men, you know. For some that were in Soviet hands, the Soviets kind of treated them with a bit of disdain, but tolerated them, filled them with vodka, did the minimum to take care of them and return them to American control. There is one exception to that, and this is a difficult part of the book, but one of the crews under Harry Miesemer was shot down. They effected a crash landing in Hungary. Hungarian partisans rushed to the aircraft to assist. The radio operator named Dale Shabilsky was wounded. The tail gunner was wounded, and the remaining crew were okay. So the partisans take the uninjured men and rush them away from the scene, and they split up the two wounded men. Dale Shabilsky is cared for medically, and then he is convinced to shed his uniform and his escape kit papers, his identification. He keeps only his dog tags and his pistol. He is given Hungarian civilian clothing, and they persuade upon him to turn himself over to the Soviets. They make their way to Budapest, and there Dale submits himself to Soviet custody. Now, Dale is a young, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, pale-skinned American, and the Soviets ignore his dog tags and his American-made pistol and begin to beat him. And within just a few hours, they ruthlessly torture him. And this goes on for a couple of days until they either give up or Dale persuades upon them to return him to American military control. Huh. I did interview Dale, and he did suffer PTSD, you know, because of these experiences for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I mean, being on a bomber crew would be would impose a psychological trauma on its own, but being treated like that.
Right.
Let me ask this. I had heard stories of Allied airmen ending up in Soviet hands and the Soviets being very reluctant to return them. Was there any, aside from this isolated case where they apparently thought he was a German spy or something, were there any signs of reluctance on the part of the Soviets to return?
Dale is the only case where there was clear reluctance. With the others, at least the ones that I have an insight into through interviews and primary source information, it was more of a, you know, we'll tolerate you, we'll take our time getting you back to your people. But they did offer assistance. And eventually 71 men would be repatriated from the Soviet Union via the port of Odessa in the Soviet Ukraine. And they returned to Italy by boat.
What about the ones who fell into German hands?
That's a whole other story, and I'm glad you asked. many were shot at on descent in their parachutes, a great many, both by civilians and by German soldiers. One crew, a B-17 crew under Robert Sinton, actually the surviving members landed near Mauthausen, which is, of course, the most notorious concentration camp in Austria. They were taken inside, and they were verbally and physically abused. That's in the book, and I did interview one of the men who experienced it. A couple of men were murdered in the parachutes. There's no polite way to say it. They were shot at and killed. Unfortunately, only one of the offenders was brought to justice on war crimes charges. For others, if they ended up in the hands of Austrians, they tended to be treated pretty well. That happened in a number of cases. And in others, they were sent to POW camps run by the Luftwaffe. So it was a mixed bag of how the Germans treated them. But
overall, generally speaking, the story of Allied prisoners, leaving aside the Soviets, were an entirely different story, but Allied prisoners in German hands generally were not treated terribly. But I imagine there is something about being part of a bomber crew that's going to generate a level of outrage on the part of the people on the ground that you wouldn't necessarily see in a ground fight.
There were a great many ticked off Austrian civilians that the men encountered. And I heard about that a little bit, literally peasants with pitchforks.
Yeah.
One man was threatened by a peasant with a pitchfork. Yeah, please go ahead.
15 bombers lost, 28 Americans killed, out of a total of about 750 planes. How did this compare to some of the other great air raids of in Europe?
Well, the bloodier ones, the raids against Regensburg and Schweinfurt, were much worse. In fact, I think the second Regensburg was 70 or so planes shot down and hundreds killed. Yeah. This was nothing like that. But for a late war mission by the 15th, this was a rough one. No doubt about it.
Yeah. I imagine a lot of these guys imagine they'd be going home soon.
By this point, I will mention, by this point, all the men were replacements. All the original crews had gone home, and they had to hit the mark of 35 missions completed before they could go home.
35. Okay.
I was lucky enough to interview men on their first mission and men on their last mission. So I covered the whole gambit. And I'm very glad to have captured so many personal accounts.
Was the raid itself regarded as a success? Did it accomplish its mission?
It did. In this case, the U.S. Air Force launched, Army Air Forces launched two reconnaissance missions, one during the raid and one shortly after it ended. And the results were, in period terms, spectacular. You know, at that point, at that time, in the technological development of strategic, you know, bombing, it was considered pretty good to land a bomb within a field, a football field of the target. They had wild success. They destroyed hundreds of the 2,000 rail cars that were there, and they severed the tracks in multiple locations. Hmm. So it was a rousing success. Yeah. In fact, one of my prized possessions is a photo. Well, it's not a possession. I made a scan of it, but it's a photo, a bomb damage assessment photo with my uncle's name on it, showing that he scored a very large concentration of hits on the target. Of course, having a silly last name like I do, they misspelled it and they put a D instead of a T at the end, but I can live with that.
So since you mentioned your uncle again, you said you embarked on this project because you wanted to know the truth of what happened to him. Did it, which was of course after the war. I imagine the shock of losing somebody who made it all the way through the war on a bomber crew, no less, which had of course a very high mortality rate, makes it through the war but dies in a plane crash when he's stateside. Did you learn more about what produced this result?
I did, unfortunately. There is a website. There's probably more by now, but when I did the research, I found a website that sold aircraft accident reports. And I was able to find a report about that accident, and it made me angry, I'm not going to lie. There was essentially one piece of equipment on that aircraft. It was a C-45 that needed to be functioning for a bad weather flight, and it had been neglected in the maintenance for days. And this pilot took off without a co-pilot, flying in heavy rain and poor conditions, and didn't have this particular instrument. It's called a needle and ball. And I wasn't able to determine the exact cause, but I would suspect, given looking at the timeline of how quickly it happened, that the pilot became disoriented and wasn't able to determine the orientation of the aircraft, and they fell from the sky.
Yeah. Well, are there other questions that you wish I had asked, or the things that you had wanted to address?
I would just like to say, you know, these men, they all volunteered for this. Mm-hmm. They were all very interested in aviation. They, not a man that I spoke to, waited to be enlisted. He volunteered because he believed in the cause. He believed in, you know, protecting this experiment in democracy that we have here in America. They signed up many on the earliest, at the very earliest time that they could, and were often told, okay, kid, come back when you're a little bit older, or just wait, we'll call you. And I'm very proud of the men. I'm very proud of my uncle. And I'm glad that I have been made the messenger of these stories. You know, it's the story of 28 young men and their last moments on Earth. It's the story of hundreds of great Americans. I didn't mention this yet, but I do spend a bit of time in the last half of the book addressing how the war affected the men. Virtually every man I spoke with suffered in some way from his war experiences. Mm. One man in particular, Hal Millett, that I got to spend a lot of time with on the phone and in person, really went into it with me, the mental and psychological recovery that he had to go through in order to get on with his life. This is a man who had a mission over Vienna on his 19th birthday, and he was in the ball turret, which is the small spherical turret underneath the bomber. It was a B-17. And Hal is, I should say was, unfortunately he's passed now, but he was a certifiable genius. He had an IQ of 160. and he was an atheist, so he tried to think and reason his way through the war, and he would spend the many hours that he was in the ball turret, not just doing his job, which was to scan the sky for fighters, but he would spend the time also just thinking through the various things that could go wrong. So on the mission, on his 19th birthday, the B-17 right next to their aircraft takes a direct hit and goes down. The concussion sends his aircraft into a dive, and he thinks they're all going to die. Now, the pilots are able to pull the aircraft out of the dive, and they all survive. But Hal decides right then and there that he's going to come up with a new credo in life, and that is the worst thing that can happen, excuse me, the best thing that can happen is that the worst thing will not happen. Mm-hmm. Now, that's pretty deep for a guy turning 19. And yeah, he would later go on to stay in the Air Force and serve in Korea. And he kept that credo for his whole life. Wow. He did lock his war memories away after the war, and it was only with the intervention of his daughter that he started to entertain the possibility of finally talking about it. He had gone so far as not even being able to remember the names of some of the men that he served with. That was how extreme he tried to lock his memories away.
This is something I've heard of in a lot of cases. Yeah. My father told me about visiting his aunt was in a nursing home, and he went there and he just started striking up conversations with some of these World War II vets. And they wanted to, I mean, they poured their hearts out and said, I have never spoken about this in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the same. I encountered the same. I had a couple of guys say, you know, no one has ever heard this before, not even my own family. Mm-hmm. So the message with Hal was, you know, he finally did begin to talk about it, and he confided in me a lot, which I will always be grateful for and consider him my friend. I spoke to Hal in the last days of his life. I called him. I believe he was in hospice care, but I could hear in the background Hal regaling the nurses with tales from the war. And it was just a heartwarming farewell to my friend to know that he had finally found peace. The book is also a message for the children of the men, because many of them, I've been told, their dads, their uncles, their grandfathers never talked about it. And I try to come to an answer for why. And I hope that they find answers in there as well.
Wow. What a terrific reason for writing a book, and what an amazing story of heroism. Thank you very much for talking with us today, Mike. The book is Bombing Hitler's Hometown, The Untold Story of the Last Mass Bomber Raid of World War II in Europe. Thanks to you, Mike. It is about to become the told story, and I look forward very much to reading it as well. And I want to thank everyone here who's listening for joining us again on The American Idea. Until next time, cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.